Welcome to Hidden Battles, Destigmatizing Mental Illness, a weekly podcast where passionate advocates of mental health converge to illuminate unseen struggles faced by millions. Join Jeremy, Terrell, and Lorraine as they delve into candid conversations about stigmas, cultural risk, values, intersectionality, and mental health. Hear from mental health professionals and those diagnosed with a mental illness. Together, they put on the table the things people think about but are afraid to talk about. Get ready to embark on an insightful journey.
Thank you for joining in on part two of a four-part series of conversations where Jeremy and Terrell sit down with Tony Goines, a respected God-fearing businessman, as he shares insights on business, life, and God.
Five, four.
Welcome back. We're sitting here with Tony Goines, owner of the Capital Cigar Lounge. He does have a business partner, Austin Hillis. I know you want to give him a shout out.
Yeah, shout out to Austin Hillis, my partner. We are partners in this business. Him and his wife, Natalie, and of course, the son, Rowan Hillis, and my beautiful wife, Kim Goines.
All right.
Shout out to my wife. You know, I always listen, as you talk about business, though, one thing I'm going to transition. You are the sum of the people that you associate with.
This is so true.
And I will tell you, I've got an amazing group of business friends and business leaders. And one of the things I say in the lounge is, you sit with winners because the conversation is different. Hashtag relationships matter. And, you know, Paul West, who is also a dear friend and a partner in our other lounge in Omaha, Apiary, Jason Metcalf, who owns Metcalf Coffee and owns close to 50 Scooters franchises.
Wow.
This guy is a phenomenal businessman. Paul Jerry, who founded a company called Voodoo Box. And then I go on, Matt and Natasha Plooster, Jay and Tanya Wilkerson, Tanya Starr and Jay Wilkerson, Matt and Natasha Plooster on Bridgepoint Investment Bank. Man, these folks are folks that I have spent a significant amount of time with. And what I will say in terms of business, like, you have to be a lifelong learner. And like, you literally have to, just because you go to college, you graduate, you get a degree, that's just the beginning. How do you learn in a practical manner every day and operationalize that learning?
Well, to add to that before you go on, yeah. I think that there has to be a level of people who have an intentionality to not rely on force to get things done, because when you become an entrepreneur, you have to have the drive to force yourself. You know, okay, great, you went to school, you did the socially acceptable thing,
sure,
but then when you get into business, you have to force yourself to turn on the podcast, you have to force yourself to read books, you have to force yourself to go out. Because when you become one of the things that I had to deal with is, when you become successful to whatever measure where you don't have a boss ordering you around, you have to learn how to self-modulate, self-control. And one of those things you just said is the lifelong learning.
Lifelong learning.
Being able to take the time,
yes,
and intentionality to take care of your body, take,
yes,
care of your brain, take care of your people around you. And so, you know, when you talk about lifelong learning, what topics are off the table?
You know, Jeremy, what I will say is, I don't know whether I would frame it as what topics are off the table versus a level of intentionality specific to learning that will help make you a holistic person. Now, my learning genre, number one, is the Bible, because I'm seeking to learn more about the Bible, because I fully believe that there is nothing on this earth that has happened that has not already happened and written in that book. So for me, on this journey of life at 61 years of age, the more I learn about the Bible and the characters in the Bible and the way they dealt with challenging situations, you know, I'm studying David, I'm studying Paul, who was once Saul, who wreaked havoc on a Christian community. And then you ask yourself, how does that switch happen?
Yeah.
How does that switch happen? How do you go from Saul to Paul?
Right.
How do you go from everything that David went through, with the death of his son Absalom and all the turmoil in his family.
Job, same thing.
Yet he was noted as a man after God's own heart. So when I'm reading those stories and I'm asking myself as I go through this journey of life, how is that applicable to me? And if they got through it, then how do I use that information to get through it? So the Bible's number one. But then as you start thinking about business, and I think for me, when you think about business, you have to think about it from a global perspective. Not just if you're an entrepreneur, like I'm not just studying cigar. I'm thinking about business at a macro level. You know, how are they doing business in Saudi Arabia? What is happening in the Middle East? What is happening in Africa? You know, what is happening in Latin America? So this, to answer your question, the study routine has to be a global study routine. So it starts at the macro, and then you bring it down to the micro. And when you bring it down to the micro level, you ask yourself, who are the best in your industry? Who are the best in your industry? And are you adopting best practices into your space to help elevate your game, to create the right culture, to attract the right talent, and to deliver a product or service that differentiates itself in the marketplace and creates a true form of capitalism. Mm-hmm. Capitalism with a purpose.
A true form of capitalism.
Form of capitalism with a purpose. Competing in the marketplace to the extent that you can win because you have customers that gravitate towards what you are offering.
Absolutely.
And that's my mindset.
But I would add to that, if you don't mind, mm-hmm. You have to have something to buy into. You want you don't want your customers to buy into the product, and I'm arbitrarily speaking, but you want them to buy them into the brand. You want them to understand the brand.
Capital Cigar Lounge is not a cigar lounge.
It's a community. Yes.
This is a community.
That's the why.
This is a community.
Right.
When Austin and I formed the Capital Cigar Lounge, it was really not just about cigars and great spirits and great cocktails. It was more so about, we saw a need in the city of Lincoln that there was no place to congregate for grown people to do something other than social media.
Right.
So yeah. It's networking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an opportunity to network.
Yeah, yeah. But you know what, Terrell? I think sometimes that word networking is overused, so I always substitute that word with relationships.
Relationships.
Because what happens, if I had a relationship with you and I spend enough time with you, then trust starts to formulate. Once trust formulates, everything is possible.
Well, and to add, if you don't mind me quick adding, like networking to me is meeting people that you can sell something to. When you get beyond the networking and you get into relationship building, you're adding to the value of each other's mission.
Value.
I'm not trying to come here and buy cigars, and you're not trying to come and get mental health counseling from me. We're trying to come together as a greater purpose to destigmatize mental health. We're trying you're trying to share your story so that people understand where you came from.
Absolutely.
And that they can do it too.
Absolutely.
You know, so 100%. That's the one.
It's a community.
Yes.
It's a community.
And it boils down to what you always hone in on, mission, purpose, and values.
Yeah.
And so what it sounds like, you want to have a relationship with people that share your values.
Absolutely.
Otherwise,
or challenge them.
Right. Or
more challenge them, you know.
We will take a break and return with more talk on business, life, and God with Tony Goines.
Mental illness doesn't only affect the person diagnosed by it, affects everyone. If you have a loved one that has been diagnosed with a mental illness and are facing challenges, NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, provides monthly confidential family support groups. You can gain support from peers who understand your experience as well as insight into challenges and successes of others because it can be overwhelming. For more information, go to www.hiddenbattlesdmi.com or call 402-200-0656. You don't have to do it alone.
Capital Cigar Lounge, where excellence is more than expected, it's experienced. Step into a space where conversations with visionaries spark ideas, relationships are forged in comfort, and members become family. At Capital Cigar Lounge, we don't just offer cigars, we offer connection, community, and a curated experience like no other. Choose from an exceptional selection of premium cigars, featuring some of the most respected and sought-after brands in the world.
Whether you're a seasoned aficionado or a curious newcomer, our knowledgeable staff and welcoming atmosphere ensure you feel right at home. Capital Cigar Lounge is a sanctuary, created to unite people, perspectives, and the timeless tradition of a fine cigar. Sit with winners and conversate. Visit us at 5505 South 16th Street, Lincoln, Nebraska 68512.
We're back. Let's listen in.
I'm cool with that. I don't know anyway.
So Tony, you are it sounds as though you are at a point in your life in terms of your relationship with your wife that is different than it was in the past. What
Good.
Changed? How much
Me?
Has your new how
Me?
Much has your
I
wife,
changed.
Wait, how much has your
That's
wife
easy question.
How much has your wife helped change and mold you into where you are at this point in your life?
So much. I mean, I could talk about that forever.
Share some of that with us.
Yeah. I mean, listen. She's helped me to be a better person. And I can quantify that. You know, she's helped me to be more vulnerable. She's helped me to, you know, we connected intellectually first from a business perspective. Because I do think that when you want to be with someone, it has to be some level of an intellectual connection. And that was the real attraction to me from the beginning. But she's also helped me understand how to be even more compassionate, because she's got this tough exterior, but I see her help people like you guys would not believe. You know, animals. Like, I ain't gonna help an animal.
Right.
My wife gonna help animals. People, kids, you know, her time at the Malone Center, her time at the Boys and Girls Club, you know, the way she cared about those kids, you know, the way she cares about our grandchildren, you know. Those are things that resonate with me in a very powerful way, and it's helped me to be a better person. And because I've become more vulnerable, it makes it easier for me to love.
No doubt. Yeah, that's really powerful. And I think that, like, you know, marriage in a lot of ways can exemplify and be the standard of how you relate to other people as well. Mm-hmm. Not obviously to the same level of intimacy or even intellectual connection, but it's kind of like the standard in which you can, is your home base on how you operate as a person.
Sure. Absolutely.
You know, and so, you know, we're going to get into your book in the next podcast, but, you know, you're the sum of your experience and who you are today. And so, just, and maybe I'm taking a step back, but what, if you don't mind talking about some experiences that you had that built the man that you are today, because obviously you had to change, but you had to go through experiences, you had to rely on a higher power, you had to go through some positives and negatives, and it sounded like, you know, when we've had conversations privately, that you have met some amazing people that gave you amazing chances that
absolutely
lifted you up. You talked about being a security guard. Would you mind telling that story? You were a security guard. You
yeah,
met the
Malcolm
owner
Mitchell.
Of the company. Yeah, tell
Malcolm
that story.
Mitchell. He was the highest ranking, one of the highest ranking black men at a company, American Express in Greensboro, North Carolina. It's over, you know, a large facility, 6,000 people. I checked this man's badge every day. I was 23 years old. I was a security guard. And Malcolm asked me one day if I could do anything else other than guard this front desk. And I said, well, I'm making $6 and a penny an hour, unloading trucks at night. I don't know what you guys do up there, but if you give me an opportunity, I think I can do something. And so he invited me to his office, and he allowed me to shadow another credit authorizer, Miguel Soto. And after 2 hours, I went back into Malcolm's office. I had taken copious notes. I regurgitated everything that Miguel was doing, and he looked at me, he said, you learned all of that in 2 hours? And I said, yes, sir. The next day, he goes down to Human Resources, tells the Human Resources chief that I want to hire a security guard to be a credit authorizer. She said, absolutely not. He has no degree, no qualification. She went down a list of everything I did not have. And you know what? She was right. I had none of the qualifications, but this man believed enough. He said, there's something special about this kid. And he says, I'm gonna hire him. And he did. So I went through credit authorization class, which is about a 6-week, very intense, very numerically driven decision, analytical type of class and position. I finished in the top percentile, and after a year on the floor as a credit authorizer, I was one of the top credit authorizers across the entire firm. And I received numerous promotions at American Express. And, you know, the rest is history. But you have Malcolm Mitchell, Neil Feldbaum, who is still a dear friend. Because class, that's why I say you got to be a lifelong learner. He afforded me the opportunity to go through a leadership class. Center for Creative Leadership, they have a huge operation. I think they have one in Switzerland, Colorado, Greensboro, North Carolina, and San Diego. So I went through the Center for Creative Leadership because Neil Feldbaum saw leadership potential in me early. He felt like it needed to be cultivated, and he sent me through a very expensive capital investment course, and that helped me to shape and formulate. What that really did was another shift, because the leadership that I had learned was military leadership,
right?
Marine Corps leadership,
right?
And there are parts of that are relevant to the corporate world, but there are parts of that are not relevant. So the Center for Creative Leadership allowed me to understand how to retain what I learned in the Marine Corps, but here are the leadership skills that are more applicable to the civilian world to add to your repertoire so that you have a greater level of influence. And Neil Feldbaum did that for me. You know, I can talk all day about Sue Wilkerson, who was my very first coach, a business coach. She was a business coach. I worked for Sue. Sue used to say, an inefficiency is an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Are you up for the challenge? An inefficiency. See, everybody can find inefficiencies. Everybody can talk about what is not working. That's really an opportunity.
Exactly.
If you are up for the challenge. That's Sue Wilkerson. You know, I can talk all day about Terry Chenault, about Reggie Van Lee, about Robert Blackwell, about Seal Mihalik. You know, these are people about Walter Davis and Angela Webb and Milton Jones. These are people that saw something in me that afforded me the opportunity. And I always say to young people, listen, if somebody affords you the opportunity, number one, respect their time, because time is something you can't get back, and deliver more than what was expected. If they say deliver A and B, you better deliver A, B, C, D, and E. Like, overachieve what is expected.
Because it's an investment for them, and they want to see
They want to see a return. So, you know, the mentors and the friends and the folks that have been around me that have poured into me, you know, I sincerely hope if they have a chance to watch this that they have seen a return, an actual return.
And the return is, the outcome is how you've benefited the world, how you've benefited.
Pay it forward.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to pay it forward. Malcolm said it to me all the time. You know, I remember saying to Malcolm one day, I don't know how to repay you. And he says, you can repay me by paying it forward. Do it for somebody else.
And that's just not a cliche. People mean that shit.
Yeah, they mean
people.
Of course they mean that.
because at the end of the day, when you die, what is your legacy? And a lot of times our legacies, you know, if we do have an effect on the world, somewhat go unnoticed, but that's that quiet ripple effect of what you do for other people, and then they do something for more people. So,
can I tell you something, Jerry?
Yeah, absolutely.
The only reason I'm doing this is to pay it forward.
Absolutely.
I'm not sitting here talking about myself just because I want to talk about myself. Yeah. I do not enjoy talking about myself. I don't. I'm a very private person. I'm an introvert. But I do recognize that God has given me a platform. I do recognize that. I do. I didn't want to admit it for a long time, but I do recognize the Bible says to whom much is given, much shall be required. And so I'm required to do this. And so you all have given me this platform, and the ups and the downs and mistakes in my life should be, it has to be told, because somebody else is going through the same thing. And if they look at me and say, you know, Tony was able to get through that, then that should give them some level of encouragement to say they can get through it too.
Absolutely.
So that's the only reason I'm doing this. These are people that saw something in me that afforded me the opportunity. And I always say to young people, listen, if somebody affords you the opportunity, number one, respect their time, because time is something you can't get back, and deliver more than what was expected. If they say deliver A and B, you better deliver A, B, C, D, and E. Like, overachieve what is expected.
Because it's an investment for them, and they want to see
a return. They want to see a return. So, you know, the mentors and the friends and the folks that have been around me that have poured into me, you know, I sincerely hope they have a chance to watch this, that they have seen a return, an actual return.
And the return is, the outcome is how you benefited the world, how you benefited.
Pay it forward.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, pay it forward. Malcolm said it to me all the time. You know, I remember saying to Malcolm one day, I don't know how to repay you. And he says, you can repay me by paying it forward. Do it for somebody else.
And that's just not a cliche. People mean that shit.
Yeah, they mean
people,
it.
People mean that. because at the end of the day, when you die, what is your legacy? And a lot of times our legacies, you know, if we do have an effect on the world, somewhat go unnoticed, but that's that quiet ripple effect of what you do for other people. And then they do something for more people. So,
can I tell you something, James?
Yeah, absolutely.
The only reason I'm doing this is to pay it forward.
Absolutely.
I'm not sitting here talking about myself just because I want to talk about myself. Yeah. I do not enjoy talking about myself. I don't. I'm a very private person. I'm an introvert. But I do recognize that God has given me a platform. I do recognize that. I do. I didn't want to admit it for a long time, but I do recognize the Bible says, to whom much is given, much shall be required. And so I'm required to do this. And so you all have given me this platform, and the ups and the downs and the mistakes in my life should be, it has to be told, because somebody else is going through the same thing. And if they look at me and say, you know, Tony was able to get through that, then that should give them some level of encouragement to say they can get through it too.
Absolutely.
So that's the only reason I'm doing this.
And I think that's part of like a digital world that has gotten lost is that, you know, like kids are using AI to have conversations. Like I know kids who will have an app downloaded on their phone, and that app is their social butterfly. That is their friend. Wow. You know, and that's a whole other
story. My pay grade.
You know what I'm saying? So we don't, you know, kids aren't being forced to tangle with people in such a way. It's all done through digital. And so, like, you said, when inefficiencies happen, it is where, you know, those are possibilities. And so when kids are having difficult times, or people are having difficult times in relationships, that's an opportunity for improvement. And so that's, I think, one of the core functions of what our conversation has been about, is pushing past the fear, doing things that you don't want to do,
correct,
you know, and accepting the responsibility that's been, you know, what you're being called to do.
Sure.
And then, you know, ensuring that we get out in front of people, and you've developed the platform here at, you know, Capital for people to get out of their phones, get out of their computers, and have conversations.
Absolutely. 100%.
And you've created this catalyst and mechanism for
people. Yeah, because let me tell you what. Let me tell you what I know to be true. This cigar, which is a byproduct of the community, is about an hour to an hour and a half commitment. Most of the time, people won't have an hour long conversation.
Right. The commitment is the puffing on the cigar.
The length of the...
It is.
And
over the cigar, you're having a conversation. Through conversation, what you actually find out is that you have more in common than you do apart. You can start talking to you.
Yes.
You come up with numerous levels of commonalities. Once you transition from the commonalities, then that's the formation of trust. You say, you know, this guy, you know, formation of trust. And so here at the Capital Cigar Lounge, we have numerous religions, numerous ethnicities, numerous political beliefs. But I've come in here and we set it up in these pods to force conversation. You notice the seating is very intentional, because it allows you to have that level of interaction.
Face to face.
Face to face.
Intimate.
Live. In person.
In person. And you rarely see people on their phones unless somebody's just working. But during the course of the conversation, you don't see people on their phones. And I'm intentional about walking around just listening to some of the conversations. And those conversations are always, typically always, very positive. So what we say is, with all the noise that is happening in the world today, turn on CNN, turn on Fox News,
whatever, all
the noise, that's all negative noise. It really is, because that negative noise sells. You leave, you can go back out there and deal with that. But when you come here, this is different.
And to talk to you as a customer, to an owner, I've never had a negative experience here. I've always felt welcome. Mm-hmm. I've never,
very intentional.
It's quiet.
Yes.
It's people are in thought. People are thinking. People are conversating, and it's the cigar that's the catalyst that allows people to, you know, like if we didn't have something to do with our hands, you know, or fidget or whatever, and we're talking, the cigar is kind of like that grounding, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying there's not other ways to ground, but I'm just saying while we're here, it's like we're talking, we're grounded, we're intentionally smoking here to let people know that when we're beyond just the podcast itself. We're demonstrating the conversations.
Absolutely.
You know, and there's nerves involved. There's fears involved. There's, I messed up 40 times on introducing us. But those things are acceptable to people. But we think in our mind that other people are going to judge us. But I didn't hear one person judging me in the room.
No.
You know, so but that's the way it is at your establishment.
And this is a platform for me to share my faith.
Absolutely.
You know, we were in church the other day, and all the guests had met in that private lounge and said, we going to church on Sunday. Mm-hmm. That's intentional also. It's very intentional. The church is not necessarily the physical church with the steeple.
Right.
You know what I mean?
It's the fellowship.
It's the fellowship. And so the intentionality here in a respectful way to say this is a veteran-owned facility, but this is a Christian-owned facility. And if you spend enough time with me, I'm going to invite you to church. If you spend enough time with me, I'm going to ask you about the Bible. Mm-hmm. I remember this very successful businessman. His name was Bert Bachman, the Bachman family. You can look him up. They own the largest and most successful Ford dealership in the world, in Los Angeles, California. It's called Galpin Motors.
Yep.
Galpin.
Familiar with him.
G-A-L-P-I-N.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when I worked for Ford Motor Company, I was promoted to run Ford's West Coast operation, which was about a $20 billion portfolio. It was headquartered in Henderson, Nevada, which is a suburb of Las Vegas. And my largest customer was Galpin Motors. That was my largest customer. And I get a call from Detroit, Michigan. They say, you got to go see Mr. Bachman. And I don't know what your faith is. I don't want you to be put off, but he is our largest client, and you need to make sure that he is satisfied. But we want to warn you that when you go see Mr. Bachman, he is going to ask you, what is your belief in Christ? Mr. Bachman's going to ask you that question. So I don't know what you're going to say, but don't make him mad. I told the boys out of Detroit, man, I welcome that conversation.
Absolutely.
That is not a problem. So sure enough, I fly into Los Angeles, get picked up, go to Galpin Motors. Mr. Bachman's office was a glass office on the second floor that overlooked the showroom floor. The dealership was so large that it had traffic lights.
Wow.
On the deal. That's how large it is.
Yeah.
You know, you guys are from LA, so you know Galpin.
Yeah.
And I walk in, I go upstairs to Mr. Bachman's office. He's got this giant Bible sitting on the front of his desk. He says, Anthony Gomez, I've heard a lot about you, but I need to know, what is your relationship with Christ? And that's where the conversation started. And Mr. Parker looked at the guys from Detroit and says, I like this guy. We're going to do a lot of business together. Sure did.
Well, and I want to
make that up.
I want to defend Christianity on some level, because they're kind of, you know, we had gone through this period of where Christianity became an enemy because of, you know, scandals and all those kinds of things, and, you know, the history of Christianity, and people can point to things, but always remember that the purveyor of violence was not the purveyor of peace. The purveyor of violence were men who utilized these tools to do bad things, but that is not what Christianity is. That is not what representatives of Christ do. And when we're out here trying to talk about religion and God, you have to get past the so-called resentments, because the media has captured the narrative, and we know a lot of times in business, whoever controls the narrative controls the outcome. So you have to look beyond whatever media outlets you're taking a look at and where you're getting your information from, because demonizing Christianity and religion takes you off of a philosophical foundation, falters you so that you don't make morally based decisions, like on how you spend your money, what you buy, who you build your relationships with. So when you lose contact with God, you lose contact with the moral foundation, so that you become a more adaptable consumer. You're more likely to spend money. You're more likely to make intentional decisions. Mm. And so you got to pull that back.
That's pretty deep, man. I ain't never thought about it like that. Mm-hmm. I just read the Bible and say, let's get it going.
But that's the thing. Like, you know, but what I see now, mm-hmm. my son wants to go to church. Mm-hmm. My son graduated from a religious school. Mm-hmm. His girlfriend, who she's dating, she's Catholic, and she graduated from a religious school in grade school. Then these little kids, my buddy Tyler, his daughter comes up to me with the Bible in her hand. Her dad don't go to church. God's calling these kids back. He is. I'm telling you, Faith and Jordan and Leia and all these little kids under the age of 12, they got Bibles in their hands. They're telling their parents, let's go to church. Nick's daughters, moms, they're all going to church. It's this call, I don't know what it is, but there's this calling. And we as Americans have to understand that regardless of what your religion is, we're being called back, and we need to listen.
You know, for me, I just use that moral system as a part of business.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's not that I lead with it, but I try to make sure that my actions are as such that it depicts the right thing. And then there's a natural conversation that leads to my faith. So, you know, I will tell you, man, I've been here in Nebraska since 2014. I moved here as a result of, you know, I've been through a number of different business catastrophes. You know, people talk about COVID, but before then, there were a number of financial crises that occurred that I had the opportunity to be a part of. You know, the most prevalent was the financial crisis in the mid-2000s.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was with a number of firms during that time. I was with Ford Motor Company in the beginning of the financial crisis, USAA, and then J.P. Morgan Chase. So I lived in New York City. It's co-located between New York and Dallas, and I was right there during the financial crisis. You know, so I had a chance to see, you know, the genesis of how things can unravel through mortgages and how these mortgages were packaged, and it actually started Southern California, in Orange County, mm-hmm. at a mortgage company called New Century. So you had New Century in Orange County that created these exotic mortgages, and those mortgages were no-doc loans, interest-only loans. I mean, you think about it logically, you give a person that has a 580 FICO score, that's simply a propensity not to pay.
Yeah.
And you don't give them $1 million house.
Yeah.
You give them $1 million house and think they're going to pay. Well, they didn't pay little Johnny, you think you're going to pay the mortgage company.
Yeah.
So at some point in time, there's going to be a default. But little did the American public know, those loans were being packaged and sold all the way across into various forms of 401ks and packages, and ended up in Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain, pigs, that literally created a global financial crisis. So when you go through something like that, you learn, like any challenge you go through, you don't learn really. You learn, but you don't really learn during good times. You learn during crisis. And leadership is easy when things are going well. Like when things are going well, everybody's a good leader.
Yeah.
Everybody can stand out when things are going well. But when you find out who your real leaders are during a crisis, who stands out, who runs to the gunfire, who really leads. And through those crises, I've found who I want to go to war with.
Yeah.
Okay. So I end up here in Nebraska because I was recruited to lead the operations for a bank, Cabela's Bank, the world's foremost bank, which was the credit card bank of Cabela's, the retail store. And that's how I ended up here. We had ended up selling that bank. We sold that bank to Capital One. We sold Cabela's to Bass Pro. I was on the deal team that helped do the due diligence and the reverse due diligence. That was an acquisition. It wasn't a merger, it was an acquisition. And so I learned a lot through that acquisition on how to sell a company. It was a $6.5 billion transaction. And from there, not long after, the governor of the state, then the governor, Pete Ricketts, called and asked me to join his cabinet to lead the economy for the state of Nebraska, which was a great calling for me, you know. Because I've been a banker in the private sector, but I'd never been in the public sector before. And as a cabinet member, I had to be confirmed by the legislature. So I had to testify, and you all have seen that on TV before when a potential cabinet member sits there and testifies in front of the legislature. He starts off at committee, then you go to the full legislature, then they take a vote. They took a vote, and I became the head of the economy for the state of Nebraska. And that was in October of 2018, and we all know what happened in March of 2019, COVID hit. So now all of a sudden I'm sitting in this chair, and it is a full-blown crisis. And I held numerous press conferences, held a press conference to shut the economy down in the state of Nebraska. And then I held another press conference to gradually and incrementally open the economy back up. But through that scenario leading the economy, I had a chance to travel the globe and do business in places that I never imagined. You know, I spent many days and weeks in Japan, South Korea. I met with the King of Jordan, King Abdullah III. I traveled to Dubai, Abu Dhabi. I did business in Vietnam with Bill Dow, 11 days in Vietnam. I did business in Germany. I did business all over the globe. Transacted with all of these different business leaders. I met with the king of the president of Kenya, President William Ruto. I hosted President Ruto here in Nebraska. It was an honor to be able to serve the state. But I share that to say, you know, business. You know, you once you gain a certain level of skills in business, they are transferable as long as you work to continue to learn. As long as you work to continue to learn. I did not have that level of experience around international transactions, but the amount of work that I put in before I would go to a country to understand that country's customs, to understand how they did business, to understand some of the pleasantries in their language was pretty intense.
Yeah.
And we created over $8.5 billion worth of economic development in 3.5 years, 7,000 jobs. We were the number one economy coming out of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. I had a chance to go to the White House.
I was going
to
ask you about that.
Yeah, I went to the White House.
You know, meet with Donald Trump.
Yeah,
he wanted to know how you pulled all this off.
Yeah, he did. He did. So the Treasury Secretary at the time was a guy named Steve Mnuchin, and the economic advisor was Larry Kudlow, and they were looking at the economic numbers across the United States and noticed that the state of Nebraska was trending differently from other states. We had the lowest unemployment, we had the highest workforce engagement, and all of our numbers and our GDP, we were still growing. Even in the midst of the pandemic, there was still some level of growth. And we had the fewest levels of businesses that were defaulting.
And we also the unemployment rate, talk about that.
Yeah, the lowest unemployment rate. And so Steve Mnuchin went into President Trump at the time and said, something different is happening in Nebraska. And President Trump called Governor Ricketts, said, we want you to come to DC and walk us through what you were doing. So it was the honor of a lifetime to fly to Washington, DC. We started off in the East Wing. They gave us a COVID test. And boy, that was the longest 15 minutes of my life. I said, man, I hope I don't come back positive. And of course, my test came back negative. We proceeded to the West Wing. And it was a really engaging conversation with Steve Mnuchin to kind of walk him through systematically how we managed through that crisis. Larry Kudlow, supply chain economics, I shared with Mr. Kudlow. I said, I've been following you since the early days of my career, and it's an honor to have a chance to meet you in person. And then, of course, the president came in, and we walked him through what we did. CNBC ranked the state of Nebraska number 7 as the best place to do business during that time period. So for us to finish in the top 10 amongst all the states in the United States was pretty gratifying.
Yeah, no doubt.
Political magazine ranked us the number one economy in the country coming out of the pandemic.
Talk about the decisions you had to make as it pertained to average Americans, or should I say Nebraskans,
yes,
from an employment standpoint,
yep,
benefits and things of that sort, because everything you just described is indicative of how that was managed. And
sure, sure.
They were looking to get out of that meeting as far as being able to help people get the benefits they needed.
Sure, sure.
Not lose their businesses. Can you kind of like...
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So we put three metrics in place first. The number one goal was not to lose, to minimize the loss of life during COVID. That was the number one goal. So how did you do that? So like I say, you got to quantify.
Yes.
In America, we looked at our hospitalization system because citizens were dying because they could not get the right treatment in the hospitals. And at the time, there was no vaccine.
Right.
Vaccine was not formulated yet. So why were they dying? Ventilators, old population in intensive care, and no ventilators, intensive care, and then overcrowding in the emergency room. And so when you looked at the hospitals, what we did was we got all the presidents of the hospitals together and we did what was called load level. So Bryan Hospital, if they were getting past 90-95% occupancy in terms of ICU, then we said, well, we're gonna send you to CHI. We started moving patients around and we had a system for those healthcare records to transfer with that patient. So here in the state of Nebraska, you never saw parking lots full of tents with patients in tents.
Yeah, yeah.
You saw that in other places.
Yeah, you did, yeah.
You never saw 18-wheelers with bodies in 18-wheelers and body bags. You never saw any of that here because we made sure that we managed, we load level across the state so that we could ensure that our patients were getting the right care so that they would live. So that was number one. Number two was how do you systematically open the businesses back up so that they could start to operate? And number three was how do you infuse capital into the system so that you stabilize the propensity for those businesses to default? So you had two ways to do that. You had a PPP, but you had to disperse the money. You had to get the money out. You had to create a system to get the money out as quickly as possible. And you had what was called EIDL loans. And these were federal dollars. And federal dollars are not easy to get out if you don't have the right systems, right, to get those dollars out in place. So we put the systems in place. We put all the community bankers on the phone. And Treasury had not yet released the guidelines to send the money out. We didn't wait for the final guidelines.
Yeah.
Every other state says we're not going to disperse money until Treasury. Well, if you look at the federal government, they move at a turtle's pace.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So we didn't wait to get the final guidelines. We started dispersing money immediately.
Yeah. Yeah.
So businesses got $12,000 checks. They got PPP loans. They got EIDL loans. And we worked with those businesses to infuse that capital into the system so they wouldn't have to lay people off. You still keep people on the payroll.
Yeah.
And then we put together a community of business leaders called Get Nebraska Growing Again. And we talked to the leaders in individual verticals, the restaurant association, the barber and beauty store, said, how do you want to open back up? And they came up with 50% capacity first, 20 feet apart. The business leaders came up with that. So if the government had come out and said, do that, then they would have said, well, we don't want to do it. Well, the government telling us what to do.
Yeah.
No, we got input from the business leaders and we systematically opened back up. We were the first state in the United States to open businesses back up. So if you think about it, three parts: keep people alive through managing the hospital system, ensure that you are infusing capital into the system, and open back up. So when we pull those three levers, that allow the state not to have the level of financial defaults that you saw in other places,
yeah,
while managing the loss of life.
Right.
And that's what gave us the number one economy in the United States.
That concludes our time with Tony Goins as he pays it forward. Join in next week when we will continue the conversation on business, life, and God. Listen to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to connect with us at hiddenbattlesdmi.com. See you on the journey.